Yeah.
For that earlier period. So maybe we can just start with things like the changes in the student body, the changes in faculty, the changes in relationship to students.
In 49 to,
period 49 to 52.
Okay. I think what we might say to begin with is that as the student body grew in number from the original 169 to what it came to be, I don't know, in 1952, I'd have to check that, we still continue to have essentially upper division students and graduate students, with a great percentage of our population, student population, I would say, credential-seeking individuals, many of whom were indeed going into education. Faculty, of course, we must recognize are great. We added, for example, in history, several more faculty, such as two people in the field of Europe, of English history, Professor Kimball and Professor Wilde. Kimball came here in 51. Wilde came, I believe, also the year 51, if I'm not mistaken. Both of whom, as I've indicated, were in the field of, yes, both 51, in the field of English history. Now, here we were, a department made up of two people in American history and two in British history, and not showing the diversity in the various fields. We really should have had four different fields of history represented. But again, I remind you that the thought was at that time, the basic philosophy was, as held by the administration, and I'll refer only to the administration without reference to individuals, that the basic philosophy was that history, and any history can be taught by an historian. You don't have to be specialized in history. That if you know American, you should be able to teach European or Far Eastern history and the rest of them. So therefore, there was no input from those who were in the department, few though we were, as to whom we should hire for the future. We were not yet a department. We were simply under a large division called social science, and therefore there was no opportunity to recruit or to seek out individuals. I remember I did recommend people whom I knew, for example, in American history, a former student I had who went on and got a PhD at Tulane. I recommended him, but I could get nowhere because the administration made the decisions with regard to faculty hiring. Now, how typical that was true throughout the campus, I can't be certain, but I would say the same prevailing concept was there as well, except in areas where the president had brought in somebody to head a program, and I think particularly of music at the moment, and also of art, where those were individuals, both of whom had been with him at L.A. State, where he had previously been the president. He brought those people with him. They were older in years, not that old, but older than I. And he had confidence in their ability to build a department and gave them the wherewithal to do it. So I think they had greater flexibility and greater freedom in the selection of faculty. I also believe that during these years you see, as far as faculty is concerned, an attitude of not having real jurisdiction, academic or otherwise, in their own areas. The feeling generally was, you're here to work and do your job. We're here to do the planning.
Were there any faculty committees at all?
What faculty committees we had were very, very small in numbers. There again, I should do some homework and go back and check to see what kind of faculty committees we had. I just don't remember being very active on committees. The first president was of the opinion that faculty waste time in committees. In fact, committees don't really make good decisions anyway. The best decisions are made by competent people, that is, individuals in charge of a certain program or whatever it might be. So we didn't really have what I call good committees. In fact, I suppose between 49 and 52, there was a little bit of consultation, but committees per se, as we think of them as deliberative groups, no.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, there was no real input, you know, coming from committees to the president. There was also, as far as faculty is concerned, a feeling that you don't engage in research. If you do, the assumption is you are neglecting your and your teaching is going to suffer because of it. Here again, I can well understand it because I think, as one looks at large universities at times, there was this idea that, you know, one's research is most important, mm-hmm. one's students don't really count, and that the way I get recognition is within my profession and my publication. So if you did research, you did it undercover, as it were. You didn't really reveal it. You kept it to yourself and never talked about it. So in that way, there wasn't an atmosphere that was conducive to sharing with anybody what your research interest mm-hmm. might be. To reveal would be dangerous, you felt. Not that it necessarily would have been, but it was considered to be.
Did the atmosphere then seem to be intellectually constraining as a result of that?
Yes, yes. Constraining to the extent that, after all, if we think of a university faculty, we think of people that are out there on the frontier seeking information, getting new knowledge, and all the rest. But I didn't feel that was an atmosphere that was on this campus at that time. In fact, it never was during the administration of the first president. His feeling was that you acquaint your students with what others have done in research, but you don't necessarily spend the time doing it. Not that you were condemned, but you were not rewarded.
To what extent do you feel that that was true in the sciences? Was there a difference between the humanities and social sciences and sciences?
To a degree, I suppose, yet the president was a scientist himself. And the faculty in science, for example, the one in zoology, Professor Ross Hardy, had done a great deal of research on desert tortoises and desert mammals before coming. And, by the way, provided for the science department many of his own collections. There would have been nothing really in science in those early years had he not brought his own collection and eventually, I think, gave it to the university. But everything had been done with him, and he had all of his stuffed mammals that he could use in the classroom. He didn't do as much research himself at that time. In fact, was not able to do so because he was having to teach a variety of courses, with most faculty being loaded with four different preparations. And many of the courses in science were essentially general in their orientation because the courses that you would offer would be a general kind of a course for a teacher. And many of our people are going to be elementary teachers, therefore they needed a general course in biology. And how general that should be, of course, was the option left to the professor. Though again, in this instance, I know that the first president, Dr. Peterson, having been himself involved in the training of teachers at San Jose, had ideas of the kinds of workshops and such. So I guess we can say that there probably was little productivity in the way of scholarship, and yet that cannot be attributed only to the atmosphere. I think it's to the workload as well. Mm-hmm. That if you had to teach large classes, and incidentally these classes kept getting bigger as we moved along, you had to teach large classes. But most of my classes in the first several years were at least 50 per class. Mm-hmm. So you had, on an average, then of at least 200 students. And then, of course, as we later moved to the campus on which we now find ourselves, though on the south campus, we had some classrooms that were larger than, of course, which we had in the apartment. So you could build up your classes to 60, 70 people. And there was no such thing as student reader money, no student assistance money, little in the way of secretarial help. So I really had to exploit my wife, you know, in that sense, because she had to do the typing of exams. And couldn't really give good, meaningful essay examinations because you just didn't have the assistance in the way of readers to do a meaningful job of reading examinations. The burden was on you. So if you gave a number of examinations and gave papers, all of which I did, I found I was putting in long, long hours, day and night, just to get my work done. So really, you couldn't do research. Mm-hmm. It was impossible.
Yeah. How did this affect the relationship?
All right, what's interesting is that I felt, even during those years, because of the nature of our student, which was a more mature person, that you built up a relationship that was just as meaningful as that which we built up in 49 and 50, just in the first year of operation. I still have letters from 51, 52 that is coming as of this recent date. And even this last week, had a note from a person in Santa Rosa, California, who had seen a professor from this institution who wanted to send a note by him to me remembering those delightful days on the lower campus, as we call it, or as we designate it today, the south campus. So you've built up, I think, good relationships with students in spite of class size. Yeah. I'm not of the opinion that class size affects, unless you get into 150, 200 people per class, really affects your relationship with a student. What really affects my relationship with a student today is that I am too involved in too many things, not only on campus, but off campus, and that my time has become limited in that sense. But I think I can get to know my students almost as well if I make myself available to them, even as them.
So if you felt that it was very much a community,
oh, yes.
In this period, and then
yes, it had not lost that feeling at all.
Mm-hmm.
Even in moving from the apartment houses on Anaheim Road to the campus here, the South Campus, we didn't lose. In fact, it still became a cooperative enterprise. The student parking basically was on what we call the hill, where today you find the student union and the cafeteria and such buildings. That was quite a hill at that time, and that's where students parked. And on a rainy day, they were bogged down, and you had administrative personnel, faculty personnel, out assisting students to get out of the mud in which they found themselves. So to me, it was like a frontier, pioneer experience. We're all in this thing together, and we work with each other. It wasn't a strong line of demarcation between faculty and students. I think there was respect, but not in the sense of boxing us into various categories. I felt that I respected my students, they respected me, and we had a meaningful, good relationship that was friendly and still at the same time scholarly. I would believe also that, you know, that's when we started student organizations, and as we started student organizations, even as early as 49-50, and then continued with them, that we had greater participation by students percentage-wise at that time than what we... with the department, and as of this day, in 1978, you can hardly get that association off the ground.
How was that club initiated?
It was two students of mine who said, well, you know, we all have a common interest here. Why can't we have a history club? I said, fine, let's have a history club. Now what do you want to do next? We found out that their interests were many. For example, one woman was a very close friend of a urologist in Los Angeles, Beverly Hills area, who was probably had, or was one, who had the finest collection of things on Leonardo da Vinci. He maintained this collection within his office. That is, he had room set aside in his professional office for just his Leonardo da Vinci collection. We'd take, for example, a field trip there. I had students, some of whom were Mexican in background, who had a keen understanding and fine appreciation of the Mexican heritage in California. They provided the club with speakers, and we brought in people that had long been in California, had been here since the beginning of the century, and who provided us with the kind of speakers we were looking for. They also became interested in research, and as a result of their interest in research, though we had little in the way of material here because we didn't have a library that was worth anything, really, some did work at USC, some did work at UCLA, and many of this was done apart from classwork. And they wanted even to give papers to each other, and we had that. They also got keenly interested as we added to the history department faculty with the addition of Professor Nalem and Kimball and Wilde. They asked these individuals to discuss their doctoral research with them, which was interesting.
Were all graduate students?
No, very few graduate students. Most of them were upper division, junior, senior, some graduate, but they would be in the minority. Most of them were upper division students. And many of them were not planning to make a profession out of history. Some of them were going to library work. Some were planning to go on to graduate work in other areas. In fact, one now is a professor of higher education at USC, Bill O'Neill. So you have a variety of individuals in there that were not necessarily committed to the idea of being historians, but they were committed to the idea of history as an interesting avocation as well.
How did the group function?
We generally had weekly meetings, and then many times would have one to two meetings a month in one of the homes. They meet in my home or one of the students' homes. Now, what was interesting is that many of the students were married and therefore had their own homes. So we met in their homes. And it would occasionally be repetitious. It would be at Phil's home, for example, every Tuesday night. the first and third Tuesday of the month, something like that. They guided the program. It was completely student-initiated. It was student-directed. I was only there as a resource person, and if they needed ideas, if such, and yet they seldom needed ideas, they were people with ideas. That is what I miss on our campus now. I think that was a delightful, rich experience, because we didn't have that many groups on campus, and of course that explains it too. If you're going to have any extracurricular activities, what are they going to be? You couldn't have that many, and so therefore with the few that we had, there was meaningful and good participation.
Now, were these sorts of things occurring in other departments here in our
To my knowledge, yes. I suppose if we go back and look at the prospector, the school yearbook, we would find a number of organizations. Because in those early days, we started to get fraternities and sororities, the Greek groups as well, and you started to get interest groups going. Today, I understand we have well over 200 interest groups on campus, which speaks well for our student population. But I would say, percentage-wise, we probably had, as I repeated or said earlier, and I'll repeat it again, I think we had greater participation because of fewer numbers and fewer opportunities.
In what way did the other industry faculty relate to the group?
Their relationship was largely by invitation, if they were asked to do something like speaking or otherwise. And the second relationship would be that we always extended an invitation to each history faculty member to be present at anything that we did. I was the one that acted as the faculty advisor, so I was always there and constantly tried to generate the interest not only among the students but also within our classes and with the faculty. And one thing I can say is that the those original members of the faculty between 1949 and 1952 were doing everything they could to continue that interest, if not by they're pushing it, at least by they're being willing to participate, and we found that very, very meaningful.
Was there a reciprocal relationship between that group in the sense of that having any effect on curriculum development?
Yes, I suppose in a way. I think beyond 52, however, when I addressed myself to that, the students were saying to me, well, when do we ever get a course on Civil War and Reconstruction? As much as they knew that that was one of the areas in which I had done quite a bit of work. So in time, when I felt that we were in a position to offer such specialized courses and rather narrow in depth, it was with those students in mind that I offered it because of the demand that they had made. I would like to say, however, that in those early years, the curriculum was sort of designed and taken over from Los Angeles State College. That was adopted in toto. For example, when I came then, I was shown what the courses were in history and sociology, and they were the courses that were taught at LA State. So we had courses that were rather general. There were no lower division courses, so there were upper division. They had, for example, U.S. since 1900, whereas today we'd make several courses out of that. At that time we made one, and I don't argue with it. I think it's still very meaningful. I think we've become quite myopic at times as historians as we look at a brief period without seeing the overall picture. We did have some courses that we were told we had to teach, and that was designed by the administration, like the Peoples of the Pacific Ocean Area, that one, which was not designed by us and an almost impossible course to teach. But we weren't rebellious. We did it, and we tried to accommodate, and people were looking, even as we hired new people. I remember we hired Dr. Peters. The very question I asked him was he'd be willing to start this kind of a course. And we all say we'll do many things when we're hired, in order to get hired. So you do have that type of thing. I think the movement in the direction of developing our own curriculum within our own disciplines comes probably after 52.
Oh, I see. So up until 52, as you were developing new courses, because you were concerned about providing the major,
that's right.
Exactly. Increasing the number of courses. But up until then, it was still according to this external design model.
That's right. And that was the model that we had from LA State. Right.
Now, what it sounds from the way in which you said it, that sometimes someone would come in, presumably to teach a course, and then not in fact teach the course. How did you internally work out things within the department?
All right. What we had to do eventually, especially in that kind of a course, we saw within the content and also the hamming of a course like Peoples of the Pacific Ocean Area, that it was almost impossible to do. And therefore, with sympathy, we extended our, you know, our condolences to those that were doing it. And in time, we're able to substitute, as we moved into a lower division curriculum, other courses in place of it. And that seemed to be acceptable to the administration. Mm-hmm. I think the basic thought was, and I can well understand it, this is post-World War II. The American people had become aware of the Pacific in a way that they had not been aware of it earlier. That is the general masses of people. Mm-hmm. And as they became aware of it, and our being in the Pacific Basin as a state, the state of California, there was the feeling that with GIs and others returning, that they would like to know where they had been. And they may have been there, but probably knew nothing about the history and geography. And the idea in the course was, as viewed by the administration, was that it was to be an integrated course. It was not strictly to be history. Mm. It was to be geography and history, that type of thing. So that even another course was recommended, and I had offered that, called History and Geography of California, that you don't offer just the history of California, you also offer the geography, and to be sure that you do it, we're putting geography into the title.
And then it was
King Paul? No, it was not. I taught it, you know, as an historian, but having to do something with land formations and all, and working rather closely with one of the men in the geography department, Dr. James Wilson. Then he and I later coordinated the field trip. Mm. But I taught a separate course in history and geography of California, and he taught one, and you can imagine what the emphasis was. And his was largely geography, and mine was largely history. The course was designed for elementary teachers, and I think that's the thing we need to recognize, is that the feeling in the administration was, we are a teacher training institution. Therefore, the old normal school concept still existed. Mm-hmm. Many of our people are going into elementary schools. They need a wide range of knowledge rather than post-hole digging, which I would agree with, because of the concept of a self-contained classroom. Mm-hmm. The teacher needs to be informed in many areas. That's why I think we had people of the Pacific Ocean area, history and geography. At that time, incidentally, the history and geography of California and the people of the Pacific Ocean area were required courses for people seeking the elementary credential.
How did you feel about that? Having come from an institution where you were presumably training people to think rather than to provide them skills to go out and teach,
mm-hmm.
In the past, and also in relationship to the other institutions in
within the area? All right.
Like UCLA.
Yeah. In answer to your first question, it would be that I had had my first 2 years of teaching at what is called today Iowa, or Northern Iowa University, then called Iowa State Teachers College. Many of the students I had there were, of course, prospective teachers, mm-hmm. or in the summer quarter, teachers coming back to upgrade themselves, because in Iowa at that time, you could teach in an elementary school with 2 years of college. That was back in 47 or 49. Therefore, some came during the summers, hopefully sometime in their whole teaching career, they might get a bachelor's degree. So I understood, basically, that kind of a philosophy, because I had taught a course called European Backgrounds of American Civilization at Iowa, and a course designed for elementary teachers. So I had introduced into it, I feel, some very unique components, such as the students had to read Toynbee, and his concept of the study of civilization, which more or less shocked people back there that I would do it, but I did nevertheless. Because I felt that even though you're teaching a course that seems to be a bread and butter course for a given curriculum, you can still give depth to it and you can still give an intellectual component to it. In answer to your second question, I would say that I think that one has to recognize in the field of higher education that there is a hierarchy. And one feels it very keenly, even in attendance at professional meetings. Let me illustrate it. Mm-hmm. For example, if somebody's there and that person teaches in a junior or community college, a person in a 4 or 5 year institution says, well, I guess that person isn't quite as good as I, so that's where he is. If you're, and at that time you notice that you're in a state college, as we were then called, and not universities at all, you went to a professional meeting and the thought was, no doubt you're hoping someday you might be at the university level and that you'll be among those of us who are dedicated to applied research, peer research, and publication, whereas you people are only engaged in that mundane activity called teaching. The pendulum, as we know, is swinging now in 1978, and whether or not we can, you know, any longer enjoy that kind of a luxury, I don't know. But at that time, 49 to 52, and even after, that luxury could be exercised and enjoyed. Therefore, the lines of demarcation were closely drawn, even within the state. The state college system was devoted to teaching, the university system was dedicated to research, and don't forget it. And I think that's why we were reminded so often that the best teaching, we were told, was done at the state college level. Some of the poorest teaching was done at the university level because you had graduate fellows doing most of the lower division courses. Whereas we could say that as we entered into a program where we introduced freshman and sophomore courses, it was people that were teaching upper division courses that also taught lower division courses. So you do feel inadequate, or did feel inadequate at that time in some sense. So I would stack my PhD and my research at that time against anybody else's. But you were looked down upon. There was a snobbishness. And even though people in our profession consider themselves liberal, and do consider themselves as dedicated to, you know, the human dimension, I still think that there were these things that were there and tragically spoiled the lines of communication.
Right. So there weren't the good lines of communication
to
UCLA?
No, very little. Your line of communication came, as I see it, we organized what we call a History Guild in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And that History Guild, which meant about every 3 months during the school year, provided a communication for people within the profession.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did this, for instance, because it was not a good library, you obviously had to use the UCLA
right.
UC library to do it. Mm-hmm. But this did still not provide an avenue for interaction with...
No, because your time was spent going to the library, not actually engaging in any kind of a dialogue with any member of your discipline. Your time was so limited in the sense of how do I get ready for those courses I meet tomorrow, that you went to the library, got the books that you really wanted, checked them out, got back to your study, whether it was in the apartment house or in the lower campus, south campus, or whether it was at home if you were fortunate to have one, and to just get through that material. So your chances of engaging in conversation, even with the faculty on this campus, were very limited. We would say, good to see you again, but you and I got to get back to preparing for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. That was essentially the pace at which you had to work.
So it sounds like there was fairly constant work pressure.
Yes, a great deal of work pressure. Because even though in 49 to 52 we added to the faculty, you're adding, yes, but you're also increasing your curriculum, and everyone still has to teach in areas that are not necessarily within an area of competency, as you would see it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, how did the student body itself change between 49 and 52? You talked about the older student body and obviously the veterans in 49, and I presume that began to change by 52 as they were graduating.
Yes, as they graduated. Yet, however, if one considers the large number of people who could realize veterans' benefits, we still had many around. So we still had I wouldn't know what the average age was in those years. I note now that the average age of a person graduating from this institution is 26, which is really considered quite a bit older, because I'm used to the idea that you graduate from college, you were 21 or 22, and that was it. But we've always had an older student population until we introduced the freshman, sophomore level. And then we've never had many students comparatively within our institution at that level, because of the very fine system of community colleges that we have in California. So as far as change, I am not conscious, as I look back, nor was I then, of any radical change within our student body population, whether it be in ethnic makeup, whether it be in ratio between the sexes, or whether it be in age grouping. I am not conscious of the fact that it really changed anything drastically. Because as you see, those early years were not necessarily just veterans. And I reemphasize, we had women re-entering. And it's not new. You know, we talk about it. We think it's very, very new, but it's not. Because I think of those many, many women that were entering at the age late 40s, early 50s. Family grown. I want to do something that I've been interested in doing. So I think we were unique in that sense. I never thought of it as being different. You know, that never entered my mind, that it was different. Because I'd had the experience back in Iowa teaching summer quarters where I had a lot of women teachers. Mm-hmm. And many of them were, you know, late 30s, 40s, 50s. So to me, this was not a new phenomenon. This was rather ordinary.
Mm-hmm. think that was there anything else in terms of the move to the temporary building when mm-hmm. that occurred that you think would be important to describe?
Perhaps we'd wonder if moving from a sort of a compact geographical location where you have everybody coming down from a second-story classroom and merging into the cantina, as we call it, where we had the canteen, whether that would change. That did change to a degree, that as you were not crossing paths as frequently as you did over at the apartment house. However, the geography was not complicated. It was very, very simple. What was interesting, however, was that we had this experience which we had in the apartments, which we had on the lower campus as we made the new move, and that was that nothing was ever completed at the time you made the move. So much to my chagrin was I'm meeting a class and a painter comes in and says, will you move all your students to the center of the room while we paint the walls? Or in one case, I remember Dr. Frank Nelson now over in Hawaii, who took his English class out in the dust and just was teaching him there. He says, I'm not going to put up with this any longer, and I'm taking him outside. We also had a dress code for professors at that time. That is the only time that a male faculty member would go without a tie would be if in the summer session and the temperature was generally high. Otherwise, you dressed in a suit and you had a shirt and a tie. We did have some that were faculty members, some of whom were a little bit recalcitrant and tried it, especially as they took their class into the dusty regions, but soon received, to my knowledge, I think, notes or verbal responses to their dress. But it was in a faculty handbook that we would be dressed in that fashion.
Was that true at Iowa, too?
Iowa, there was never, to my knowledge, a dress code, but I never saw a male professor ever dressed in anything but a suit. You never had an open collar. Of course, back in 47 to 49, it was rather typical. Yeah. And, of course, women in slacks would not be heard of at that time, or in the early years of our campus here in California, here in Long Beach. So why there was no dress code for women, I guess it was just understood. There was nothing else for them to be dressed in but a skirt and a blouse and a dress. Slacks hadn't come in. But with men, there were options, even at that time, that you would wear a sports shirt, but you would not be dressed that way on campus. So that kind of made for a separation between the faculty and the students in that sense. So, you know, it's the way I feel on a given day as to how I dress.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nobody that tells me how to dress. Some days you feel comfortable with a tie, and the other days you don't. Then you look at what your day's appointments are going to be and the kind of people you're going to meet. And if you meet people from the business community, you feel, well, perhaps I should be dressed, you know, with a coat and shirt and tie. But we did have a definite code of dress at that
time. Tell me what some of the other things were in the faculty handbook regarding your behavior.
That, I think we can say, was not in any way dictated to us. In the early years, nothing was ever said about, you know, whether or not you should do this in the community or that, other than a positive. We expect you to be a contributor to the community in a positive way. Perhaps I can illustrate this, because it was very frightening to me years later when I got feedback on it. There was a thought about starting a United Nations chapter here in the city of Long Beach, and such a group was meeting at the local YWCA, downtown Long Beach. Prior to that meeting, Dr. Peterson, the president, asked if I would meet with a group in Los Angeles, and because I was in the social science area, I did so. Had a very interesting evening. Then I was asked to speak in the community. We were asked to participate as much in the community as we could, to let the community be knowledgeable of the fact that there was such a school. In fact, the biggest problem, by way of a tangent, is to say this, that people always confuse us with Long Beach Junior College or Long Beach City College. And when you said, no, I'm at Cal State or Long Beach State College, they say, well, where is that? All right, so our idea was to get into the community and be visible. I spoke to a group at the Y, a group that was interested in the whole concept of a World Federation of Nations. And I was to address myself to a historical analysis of this, to whether people in the past had ever been interested. I went back even to Dante and you know, even to the ancient Greeks and all the rest. I gave a speech and fine, I got a nice letter. Years later, however, just to follow through, I was asked whether I would do some writing for a particular organization here in Southern California, quite conservative. And that organization ran an investigation of me.
Now, this was in the mid-50s.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This was mid to late 50s, really. Well, quite late 50s. This would be after, I can identify it as after 57.
Hmm.
So Harvard was more in the early 60s. Well, I was asked later by the person, can we get verification from you? We've run an FBI check on you. And did you, on this given date in Long Beach, speak to this group on a World Federation of Nations? And I said, yes, I did. Well, it's in your record, and, you know, that was considered a subversive group. But, you know, that was frightening to me, frightening in the sense that, one, if that these records are kept on an individual, that surprised me. And then secondly, in the sense that here I was trying to be a contributing member to the community, and yet that kind of a meeting having been visited by people that were presenting information to the FBI. But that's on a tangent, Sherna, but I think I would like to say is that we were considered to be faculty who should be involved, and I got greatly involved in the community. I gave a lot of talks for the community. I still do it today. In fact, just Monday of this week, I spoke for the E-Bell Club at the suggestion of Don Gill and Steve Horn. They do it generally, but if they can't do it, I do this type of thing, to give them a feel for what the university is all about. I had the feeling, and did have the feeling then, the way you bridge the gap between town and gown is that the faculty are out there being seen and being visible. Because we ran into the problem later that we were called the Little Red Schoolhouse on the Hill, and that this was a place filled with commies and all the rest. And the typical resident of Long Beach, being rather conservative, had fears of what a university would be doing. Of course, we were only a college then, or a university, not that we've changed that much. But would it be sort of a hotbed for liberal people? And I don't think that that's ever been true here. I think we've had the complete spectrum, politically, socially, economically, as far as our faculty is concerned.
So even in that period up to 52, when you had so much preparation to do, there was still
Yes. In fact, if you were considered for retention or promotion, one thing that was looked at very closely was your community participation. And you made it a point to document everything that you did. We did not have a speakers bureau, so that if the community could call, and if any community could call and say, do you have anybody who can speak or address himself or herself to this topic? It was largely through word of mouth that the it got around. So I did a lot for service groups, Kiwanis, Rotary, Lions. I spoke for a number of women's groups, Seroptimist groups. I spoke for church groups, interest groups, the Friday morning discussion club, you know, a variety of things, creative writing groups. So it came to be where I was extremely involved, in fact, overly extended as far as my time and my energy was concerned, but I believe that it was a part of my responsibility, and the handbook did say you should be involved in the community, which I think is positive.
Now, was this true of your social life as well, or was it out in the community, or was it still within the university community?
My social life became extended into the community, yes. In fact, I would say that 90% of my social life is in the community, not among the faculty.
Was that up to 52?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, even then, because by my getting involved, I got to know people. Mm. And by knowing people and getting involved and even being a joiner to a degree myself, I got to know a lot of people. And as a result, my adjustment and my family's adjustment to Long Beach came not so much through affiliation or socialization with faculty, as it came to be through interested people in the community that invited us, for example, for Thanksgiving dinner or whatever it might be. We got involved that way.
Now, I think those are the questions I had in terms of covering the period, getting some of the details of the life on campus between 49 and 52.
No, I think if nothing comes to mind at the moment that I can add to it, I feel that there are a lot of gaps, you know, that I haven't thought about that I should have. What happens, you know, as I see it, as I look back historically, you can remember certain things because 49 and 52 was a great transition from the apartment house to the new campus. and the voting of the people of the city of Long Beach to give this land to the state of California to build the institution. So you have things on which pegs in which you can hang things. Then as you move along later, you don't always have those associations in the way of something real physical.
Yeah.
Like I know when we occupied the buildings on the upper campus or the north campus, because I can associate it with something. Then things get blurred after.
Right.
You know, how many faculty you added, you'd have to go back, and I would have to go back to look. Mm-hmm.